higher education in the Lehigh Valley. That's our topic this evening. More specifically, Lafayette College. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. I'm John Pierce, your host. Our engineer is Neil Heaver. He's our operations director. And my guest this evening, I'm very pleased to have Dr. Robert Wiener, who is professor of history and Jewish chaplain at Lafayette College. Bob was born and raised in Philadelphia, married, had a family at a young age. Bob, how young was that?
23.
Yeah, nowadays I guess we consider that a...
By 29, no PhD, three children and swings in front of me.
Oh, and you've survived this long.
Survival is the
had
word.
Had a great career.
54 years.
Three sons and four grandsons.
Yes.
No daughters.
Nothing doing.
No granddaughters.
Not yet.
All right. Not yet. There's always hope. So Dr. Wiener has an AB from Temple University. Now, this is what interests me. A Hebrew teacher's certificate from Gratz Hebrew College, which
yes.
I didn't know about,
yeah.
From Philadelphia. So is that a certificate to teach Hebrew?
Yes.
All right. Is it classical or modern Hebrew?
Both. Interesting. The reason I don't have my Bachelor of Hebrew Literature is in that fateful summer in which I turned 21, I first got married. And I didn't think I should be going to two colleges full-time in the first year of getting married, during which I was also teaching about 8 to 10 hours a week in local synagogues. So that was about enough. And that program was magnificent because most of the faculty were rabbis and PhDs or just PhDs or just rabbis or poets. And the students came from all over the city of Philadelphia.
Was the teaching done in Hebrew?
Most of the teaching was done in Hebrew.
Oh.
Yeah.
And so some of these people would go on to become rabbis or
oh, sure.
cantors
sure.
Or
principals or I would say in my class, and I was thinking about this morning that you might ask, the weakest of the students got a PhD in psychology and was, I think, superintendent of schools for Texas.
Oh.
He was also a high school quarterback.
Oh. All right. So that's education in Philadelphia. And then you went far afield to Rutgers for
right.
your PhD.
Right.
So you crossed the river.
Yes.
Dr. Wiener's main teaching and research fields are modern Europe, modern France, modern Jewish history, Holocaust studies, and oral history.
Yes.
What do you mean by oral history?
Well, it's a newer discipline. It's mainstreamed at this point. But with three children, I realized early in my career that I could not do what I had originally intended to do, which is be an archive rat. Because one doesn't leave one's spouse. At least I didn't.
Yeah, right. It's not recommended.
Which is one of the reasons why we were together 54 yeah. good years.
Congratulations.
Yes, yes.
And let's give a shout out to Sandra, right?
Sandra is doing this. It's actually Sanda.
Sanda.
Sanda Fay.
I saw that on the notes that you sent me about
yes.
your biography,
yeah.
and I immediately corrected it.
Yeah,
and so it was a false correction.
Very funny. Sanda Fay.
Sanda Fay.
But her brother's name is Fred David because the in-laws couldn't decide whether it was Fred or David. So it's one word, Fred David, better known as Footy.
Okay.
But I began doing oral history in the mid-1980s. In situations in which I can go to France for 3 weeks, get the right connections, interview 20, 30 people, hit hard, tape it, come back, and work on it, and create my own primary source database through oral history. And there's a whole methodology of that. And so I went to Columbia University for a three-week program and the do's and don'ts and ethical principles of oral history and all the rest of that stuff. But when my children got old enough that I could leave the maison for a couple of months, I took a group of Lafayette students to France for the first time for for 5 months in 1993, and in Dijon, France. Why? Because there is a language institute there.
Not for the mustard?
Not for the mustard. Now made in Kansas. Now made in Kansas.
Is it?
But the wine is still made in Bourgogne, in Burgundy.
Well, President Trump will be ecstatic, that Dijon mustard is made in Kansas.
That's right. But they get all the credit anyway. And the mustard is darn good. So I spent 5 months there, and I became a member of the Jewish community of Dijon and came home with about 30 interviews and 7 booklets of field notes.
All right. Now, who were the people that you interviewed in France?
At this time, I interviewed average people, the members of the synagogue, from left to right, from traditional to secular, whereas in the 80s, I was working on French elites in Paris.
All right.
So most of the research on France is done in Paris.
Is it all Jews that you...
In this particular case, almost all, although there are friends of the community. And one of the most positive things that's happened, especially after 2000 and 9/11, is that the Jewish community has opened up, and there are a number of French Catholics and Protestants who are comfortable in the synagogue, who may study with the rabbi. The rabbi studies with priests and ministers, occasionally maybe a Muslim cleric.
Now, this is in Dijon
this
that
is
you're talking.
In Dijon, right. Yeah. And, of course, politics and public opinion determines the flexibility of that encounter. But I did arrive one day to see my friends, and there were 2 teenage Muslim women waiting to have a discussion with the rabbi.
Wonderful.
So, and he's from Morocco. You would not know what his ethnic background was, because he looks as Arabic as he looks Jewish.
Oh, how about it?
Yeah. So I fell in love with the people there, and I've been back to Dijon virtually every year since then. Including another 5-month trip in 2000. And the result of all of that was a book in 2012 with my dear friend and colleague Richard Sharpless, Voices of French Jews, Interviews of the Jews of Dijon, An Uncertain Future.
An Uncertain Future.
Right.
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 What drew you particularly to France to do this project rather than another country?
Well, it's the same question as what drew me to French history. Several things. One was my love of French language. If I were a better linguist, maybe I'd be a language prof. But history was really always my thing. And I could do as well as almost everyone else in languages. In history, I was usually on the top.
So did you start your studies of French in high school?
I studied in high school. I studied just a year and a half in college. With that, I was already able to use primary sources, published documents, all kinds of things like that. And then the real total fluency came when I first went in 1993. I mean, fluency in reading, obviously, but fluency in the sense that I pick up a telephone once every 2 weeks and call my friends.
That's terrific.
That's love. But the other thing is, France was the first nation in Europe in which Jews got equality. And even if the equality wasn't complete socially and in other ways, 1790, 1791, emancipation, and that spread with the armies of Napoleon throughout much of the rest of Europe, and there's a reaction against it. It backslides, but it never backslides fully in France until the Dreyfus Affair, which is well known, and then until the Vichy regime during World War II, when the official French government collaborated with the Nazi occupation.
Right, so there's a rich history in France, and particularly with the Jewish population.
Right.
What drew you within France to Dijon particularly?
Not mustard. If I had known about the Burgundy wine, Givenchy Martin and Meursault, I might have gone there specially for that. Again, we had a program. And if I had seen Strasbourg,
you mean Lafayette College.
Had a program. I took the second group. Before doing it, I went and saw that there was a synagogue, so there was a research base. There were enough people living there that I could do oral history from the bottom up. Previously, I had done it from the top down with Parisian elites.
Was there no one else doing this kind of oral history in France that you know of?
Not many, and if they were doing it, they weren't doing it in Provence. They weren't doing it outside of Paris. So almost all of French history is Paris-based, and almost half the community is outside of Paris. So you don't get a true picture. And if I were teaching in a large graduate school instead of an undergraduate institution, what I would be doing is sending my students to all the smaller communities of France, size of Dijon, and doing the same kind of ground studies. Now, some of that has been done by French scholars in the last 10 years, but still there's a tremendous amount to be done.
Dr. Robert Wiener, professor of history and Jewish chaplain at Lafayette College, is our guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. We're going to talk some about, we've been talking about his beginnings with his education and coming from Philadelphia and being very interested in doing history of France and doing projects having to do with folks. In fact, as you said, the oral histories that you've done been really about Joe Lunchbucket out there.
That's right.
The people who are not in prominent positions.
That's right.
I think that started with Voltaire as a historian, thinking that we don't have to look only at kings and generals, and so on.
Voltaire, so Gibbon, all the rest.
You're following along that tradition.
Yes. The Aufklärung, the Haskalah in Hebrew, the Enlightenment.
<All right. laughs> Finally, I understood a word you said there. So let's go back to the time that you received your PhD from Rutgers, 1973. Was that the year that you came to Lafayette College?
No. I got to Lafayette in 1969. No PhD, having finished perhaps 75% of my research, because when I got to Europe, I realized that my PhD topic had just been scooped by a Cambridge scholar who spent 7 full years and published a book on what my topic was supposed to be.
Oh.
The French foreign minister, Théophile Delcassé. And did not have a nervous breakdown. My advisor told me to come home and find another topic. And I said, if I come home, getting back here may be unlikely with an 18-month-old child.
Yes.
And very little financial backup. So I ended up doing the most important French ambassador at the time, named Paul Cambon, and he ended up negotiating the Entente Cordiale, the Franco-British reconciliation in the pre-World War I era, and had a career almost as long as mine in diplomacy. Until about 1922, he was still French ambassador to Great Britain, and he had gotten there in 1899 and was in government service since 1870. So my field originally was foreign policy, French foreign policy, in particular diplomatic history, origins of World War I, and origins of World War II. And I still teach those fields and love them dearly, so that the first half of my career was grounded in European history.
Right. Now, you started at Lafayette College in 1969.
Yeah.
Because there was a position, they needed a historian?
Great story. My father died when I was 16. I'm an only child. My in-laws didn't have a great health pattern. I drew a circle around Philadelphia from Europe There are about 20 colleges and universities in that circle. And I sent letters to every single one of them. And I got positive returns for interviews from Lafayette and Penn. Est-ce que Monsieur Jean de Bienne est là? Is Mr. Jean de Bienne there? He was the department head at Lafayette College. Kind of became my second father. Very, very liberal German-American background. Looked at my resume, which I did not cleanse. My middle name is Israel, and I attended a Hebrew college. In the 60s, my peers were cleansing their resumes for graduate school, law school, and medical school. Probably 60, 75% of them were not specifying anything in a Jewish cultural or religious background.
You decided to go the other way.
Didn't want to be anywhere where I wouldn't be comfortable.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And so at that time, are you aware of what the percentage of students at Lafayette who were Jewish?
Absolutely. I counted every one. The number was 15, higher than today, okay. Because there were more Jews living in the tri-state area than now.
All right. So,
okay, so it's pure demographic.
All right. So today then at Lafayette College.
About 12%.
12%.
10 to 12%.
All right.
Yeah. We go out with fish hooks to bring them in. I go out with fish hooks and my colleagues.
So we're getting ready to take a break. But we're talking now about Dr. Wiener and his arrival at Lafayette College. And we're going to talk about his career there, where he has been now for
I'm almost going into my 50th year. When this airs, I will be in my 50th year.
That
a privilege.
That is a career, for sure. And we're going to explore all that and find out what he found when he arrived at Lafayette College, as far as the student body, as far as his teaching, particularly when he taught history, and perhaps his... Were you the Jewish chaplain right from the get-go?
No, but part of that story will be, why did I become the Jewish chaplain? I was in my assimilation pattern when I arrived at Lafayette College.
Okay. Well, we'll do that after we take our break. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. Glad to have you join us this evening for this chat about higher education in the Lehigh Valley with Dr. Robert Wiener, who is professor of history and the Jewish chaplain at Lafayette College. Stay with us now, and we will be back in just a moment.
Not only is becoming a WDIY member a great way to support the programs you love, it has its benefits. WDIY members have access to our weekly member ticket giveaway emails. Discover great concerts, theater performances, film screenings, and more, all while supporting the many choices and real voices on WDIY. Make your gift today at 610-694-8100, extension 7, or wdiy.org. Thank you.
Dr. Robert Wiener. Let me ask you, Bob, you talked about not being the Jewish chaplain right away when you arrived
right
at Lafayette. What year did you become the chaplain?
Well, it's more complicated than that. I became, quote-unquote, the Jewish chaplain about 25 years ago, but I became the Hillel director within 2 weeks of getting to campus.
Uh-huh.
Because what I found at Lafayette College was a community in which Jews and even Catholics were not fully welcome. It's the last year of all-male school.
Right.
A relatively liberal president, liberal humanities and social science faculty for the most part, more conservative science faculty, pretty conservative engineering faculty, but half the things that were common occurrences at Lafayette College, including my interview, would be illegal today.
Oh, what happened in your interview?
I was asked what kind of a Jew I was when I was applying for a position in European history.
Whoa.
I was asked for my political position with respect to Israel.
Oh.
I was asked if I had studied with Eugene Genovese at Rutgers. He was a big Marxist scholar at that point. Jandabin, who had brought me in for the interview, came back to his office afterwards and apologized, but also he was kicking the provost under the table. He was about 6 foot one. He had ungainly long legs, and I'm being asked these questions that are really inappropriate.
Wow.
And he wanted me to come. He wanted me at Lafayette.
This was the department head
in
history.
This was the department head, and he wanted to change Lafayette in the same way as he was already in the process of changing it with respect to coeducation. He was one of the faculty leaders, and he was one of the faculty leaders who helped develop the first Black cultural center. So I had the incredible good fortune to find this in wonderfully sympathetic human being who himself had suffered as a German-American, not being able to get clearances and things like that, but who had studied in Italy and seen Mussolini personally.
He was Christian.
He was Lutheran.
Lutheran.
Okay. Liberal. Same political philosophy.
Could have been
mine.
Over at Muhlenberg College as a Lutheran, huh?
Could have been over.
That's one got away from Muhlenberg.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Instead, we were Presby.
Yeah, that's right. So this is,
and he was a Lafayette alum from 34 also.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So you fell into a really good situation with your department head.
I fell into a good situation with my department head, and reacting to this unnatural situation as a Jewish faculty member, I immediately went first, second week to religious services to see what was going on, and they only had five youngsters when you need 10 for a quorum. And I basically became the Jewish chaplain in fact, if not in word, within 2 weeks. And one of the members of the board of directors at Lafayette right now came to see me very early on, and he said, "What kind of mistake did they make? Did they know who you were?" Now, he is now one of the main donors of the college.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well,
so that story was a good story, and we introduced Jewish studies within 2 years, and we also funded a Hillel House, which may very well have been the first Hillel House owned directly by a community of a college in this country. Universities had separate Hillel Houses, but not colleges. And I just knew that the students needed someplace to be at home, fully at home, in the social environment.
Were there other faculty members who were Jewish at
yes,
that time?
Yes, but they were mainly countercultural. They were wonderful. They were brilliant. They were fun. They were integrated with everything. I was integrated with everything. It was a phenomenal time to be a young faculty member and have young children, and almost nothing like it. I think the closest in enjoyment to that early 70s time period with civil rights in Vietnam has actually been the last half a dozen years, because the quality of our students has gotten so strong that the environment, from a different perspective, because we've achieved diversity, is as exciting as it was during the first half of the 1970s.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Right. When you arrived in 1969, now you've just mentioned that it was somewhat of a turbulent era. We had just had that year of 1968, Mai 68.
That's right.
It was a big one in France.
That's right.
So I remember there was an organization called Students for Democratic Society.
SDS. Big chapter at Rutgers.
But not at Lafayette.
We had some.
Did you?
We had Vietnam vets. We had one of the leaders. We had a wonderful Vietnam vet and some other wonderful students, some of whom I still see. And we did have a student strike and all the rest. And the head of ROTC, the student captain of ROTC, who is now a judge in New Jersey, couldn't go on strike as a cadet, but stopped coming to class and did independent study with me.
Oh.
Yeah. So his way of dealing with the situation ethically was to find a different thing that he could do that was legal but still ethical, and that's how he coped. And I taught his son 20 years later, 25 years later.
Yeah. Time marches on. Now, when you arrived at Lafayette, I imagine that the history department was in that beautiful mansion on Cattell Street. Right or no?
No, I brought the department to that beautiful mansion as department head.
Well, I'm glad to know that.
Yes. We were in the second floor corner of Pardee Hall. The department head's office was right across from mine. He stuck me after 3 years. He got me right across so we could scream back and forth. And when he retired, he made sure I got his office. So the first streaking, when it took place, I watched it.
Oh.
Because my window looked right on one of the funniest and unfortunate fraternity houses that we had that time around the quad. And the person who streaked, if that's grammatically correct, is now a three-piece suit attorney.
Okay. Oh, you had just one streaker?
We had many, but he was the first.
He was the first.
His name was Steve. I won't give you the second.
All right. Well, now your window looked out on this place wherever the path.
I could see the whole quad.
But now you could have averted your eyes.
I didn't wish to. And so, I was sitting with another student who was also an attorney now.
Oh, we have such an honest guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse, Dr. Robert Wiener. You mentioned before that just at about the time we're talking about, 1970, Lafayette College decided to go co-ed.
Right.
Why?
Survival, most important issue, quality, awareness of social change, ethics, all of it wrapped up in one whole. It was a very strange place without women. It was fascinating, first time I had ever been in that kind of environment. But it wasn't a healthy environment, I don't think.
Yeah, I think you're right about that survival. I mean, it comes down to economics.
Yes.
At the end.
Yeah.
And, of course, you get diversity when you have women on campus. And this has happened typically in the northeast of the country, where you had male schools and female schools.
Yeah.
And then many of them, and most of them, have gone co-ed at this point.
Yes.
So we still have Cedar Crest College in the valley that's female, though men can take courses and sometimes do, but it's still pretty much a female college. I talked to a colleague there once, Dick Schneer, who taught Spanish, and it was back in the days when they were saying, better dead than co-ed.
Right.
And way back in the 70s, I think. And he said if Cedar Crest were to go co-ed, then it would not be special. It wouldn't have its niche anymore. It would be like the other colleges in the area. So Muhlenberg College went co-ed, so did Lafayette College, so did Lehigh University.
Yeah.
And I think that what used to be Allentown College of St. Francis de Sales always was co-ed.
I believe so.
From the beginning. That was in the 60s that developed.
Yeah.
So the co-education has been a really important movement in the northeast of the country. Can you remember the decades or eras in college culture, the most important changes that occurred?
Yeah. It's kind of fascinating, at least at Lafayette. Some of the changes are dictated by different presidents whose tenure may encompass a decade or so. And some of it is dictated by the national trends and the economic trends and the regional trends. But at Lafayette, it almost was decade long that in the 70s, there was a lot of emphasis on technology and the attempt to bridge humanities, social sciences, and technology together. There was a lot of federal money for those kinds of things, Mellon grants for those kinds of things. The 80s at Lafayette had a lot to do with internationalization, globalism. We called it internationalism at that point. Really updating our curriculum and beginning some diversity, attracting more international students, and all kinds of things like that. The 90s, we dipped. From the late 80s to the mid-90s was the only time period at Lafayette in which, for whatever reason, the quality of students dipped, and I remember having to adapt my teaching methods and expectations to the realization that students, for the first time in my career, had different expectations of what they wanted to do from what I wanted them to do.
Oh.
And since they basically wanted to read less, I made them write more. And I had learned that technique from taking students off campus. So part of the internationalism was our study programs abroad. And I've been abroad with students almost 20 times. Berlin, Prague, Munich, Israel, Jordan, Egypt, France, Russia. And that's been one of the most wonderful opportunities and magnificent opportunities in my career, linguistically and educationally and personally in every other way. So what we did in these programs abroad is we had the students keep journals. And what I decided to do in the 90s is have the students in my classes write journals since they didn't want to read. Well, if you're going to write something, you have to read something. Mm-hmm. And we worked it out. And it was remedial, but of course I didn't tell them it was remedial. I told them it was an opportunity to express themselves, react to the readings in a different kind of way, be more personal. And what I learned through that is that writing has a lot to do with fear. And if you write in a journal format, just the act of doing it 2-3 times a week abates the fear, and you have a better opportunity to be productive, and that same skill can carry over to your analytical essays. So I always gave take-home essays and these journals, and I still do it to this day. Students write 70 to 90 pages in every class they take with me, and I let them know that on the first day of the class. So it's writing intensive and all the rest. In the 90s and during the last 15 years, we've just expanded incredibly in terms of major building structures. And then diversity in waves became the most important thing. Urban diversity, national diversity, international diversity, faculty diversity, student diversity.
So some of that is gearing scholarships towards students who are not well off.
A lot of that was, and I had the good fortune to be part of that as head of one of the committees that brought through the faculty one of those first things. Urban, they're called posse groups, where students get special training an entire year before they come to the college. And when they get to the college, they're ready to go.
Where do they do that training before?
Where they are, in New York, in Washington, it could be Chicago, and they meet in groups. They have faculty advisors when they come to Lafayette, and they help change the campus. About 15, 20 years ago, we began to use the words change agents, and we began to also employ a series of multicultural, usually African-American, but not always Latino, deans or associate deans on the campus, and they helped guide this also. And right now we have some phenomenal folks who I hope will stay at Lafayette College for a very long time.
Yeah. Do you know nowadays at Lafayette how many different countries students come from?
It's got to be 40.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Around that.
Yes.
Probably 20% of our student body is international. If not 20, it's 15%.
Right.
And
of a total student body of how many?
2650 right now, probably going to about 28, 29.
Wow. That's really getting large.
Yes.
Back in the days of the 2000, 2200.
Or 1800 even.
Yes.
No, that's a real issue, and the most special thing about Lafayette College is close faculty-student relationships, community, mentoring, private research with faculty members, independent study, honors work, all of those kinds of things. So the most important thing is not to lose those incredible opportunities that
as
make Lafayette
grow.
We grow.
Yes.
So the faculty grows apace with the student body numbers, fortunately.
And Lafayette College has had some dispute with the city of Easton.
Oh, yes.
About buildings. How's that going nowadays?
I think the city, the community may be appealing it. Lafayette brings so much to Easton. The town of Easton without Lafayette wouldn't be very interesting, other than now we have such wonderful food. And I love Easton. I love the restaurants.
You have some artistic.
Tremendous artistic.
Too.
But again, yes. A lot of that comes from the college, from the arts campus downtown, from that magnificent building that Ed Kearns had a lot to say about as the head of the art department at that time.
Is that Buck Hall?
No, that's the one next to it, before
next
Buck
to,
Hall.
Okay.
Ed had a lot to say about the light and the structure of it. Is a very important artist.
And just for folks who are not too familiar with the campus, you have College Hill, which is truly up on a hill.
Right.
And what we're talking about now is down at the level of Easton.
That's right. And the goal is to bring Easton into that, too, to share, to have more opportunities for the people of Easton all over the campus, whether it's sports activities, cultural activities, library, whatever, people are welcome and they get opportunities for small fees that you have to go to New York to get.
Right.
And it is unfortunate. I can understand the position of the people who live on the hill, or some of the people who live on the hill, who fear the expansion. But I think the expansion will take place.
It's certainly Lafayette has been a good neighbor in Easton, and whatever decisions are made, we just hope that it's going to be a good town and gown relationship.
Absolutely. Lafayette has changed a great deal. One of the single most important changes, which will burn the ears of some people who might be listening, is the reduction in number of fraternities. 25 years ago, when I would come on campus on a Sunday morning, there were beer cans everywhere. And you don't have that now. There was all kind of incursions into the surrounding areas by students who had had too much to drink.
Yeah, they were rowdy.
They were rowdy.
So we're going to continue this conversation right after our break, which we must take, unfortunately, right now. Folks, stay with us. We're talking about Lafayette College, particularly higher education in the Lehigh Valley, with Dr. Robert Wiener, professor of history and Jewish chaplain at Lafayette College. I'm John Pierce, your host. Neil Heaver is working the board for us this evening, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture, from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Brittany, and Galicia, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar, every Thursday from 7 to 9, here on WDIY.
Dr. Robert Wiener, a professor of history and Jewish chaplain at Lafayette College, has authored many articles and several co-authored books, especially, let's mention this one, Bob, The Long 19th Century and an Uncertain Future, Voices of French Jews, the Jews of Dijon. You talked to us before about the oral histories that you did there. It's a fascinating topic, the long 19th century. Why is that in the title, the long 19th century?
Well, scholars disagree as to when the 19th century began and when did it end. My own sense was that you can take it back to the French Revolution through World War I.
That is long.
That's long.
Okay.
And then you get the short 20th century, although there's a lot of debate about that also. So even in my 19th century Europe course, I always began at least a week on the period or 2 weeks on the period prior to 1848 and the beginning of more modern nationalism and things like that. That experience with the teaching company was in some ways the single most perfect academic opportunity in marriage that I ever had, because they send agents out to find faculty members who have become noted local instructors at colleges and universities, and they look for talent pools. And they called me, came to my class, had me go down to Washington to interview and to show what I could do. And then we reached this agreement. And when I did it, I didn't realize that these tapes that were made and come in multiple forms also come out in printed books. So in my 19th century Europe course, I used my own three published booklets on the 19th century from the teaching company. So the students essentially will have my best attempt at formal half-hour lectures before we have the discussions about those lectures and all the primary sources associated with them. So it was just the perfect opportunity to merge my deepest interests in teaching with research and publication and all the rest of that stuff.
So one of the books that you would require of the students is The Long 19th
Century.
It is
The Long 19th Century, yes.
And what are the other two books?
The long 19th century is broken up into three parts.
Okay.
1848, then let's say 1871 to 1917, 1918, and 1789 to 1848. Okay. And then in my classes, they're going to have another four or five books to read.
Mm-hmm. And lots of writing.
And lots of writing.
Now, you mentioned that the less interest in reading on the part of the students came around about late 80s into the mid-90s.
Late 80s, mid-late 90s, Lafayette had become a less interesting school and community, even though the faculty continued to be first rate.
So what has happened in the meantime?
Well,
with the students' interest?
Since then, what happened is we got a president, Art Rothkopf, who really found a way to confront that with the faculty. And we came to control the worst elements of the rowdy behavior, the inappropriate behavior, and find other students who were more suited for a first-rate academic experience, mm-hmm. who wanted it. And also part of that was building up departments that were not as strong as other departments. So our theater program is now quite strong. Our music program is strong. Our philosophy program is strong. Our religion program is strong. We really expanded the quality of opportunity globally, academically, and physically with new buildings in a way that could recruit students from all over the country and indeed all over the world. And over time, working with very, very hardworking and capable deans, directors of admissions, we got the kind of students finally that we wanted to have all the time, and similar in some ways to the kinds of students we had in the early 1970s. Really youngsters who, for the most part, are there because they want to learn, and they're skilled in many, many areas. They can be first-rate students and athletes, or first-rate students and singers or musicians, any number of things, writers. Lafayette students multitask, sometimes more than the faculty would like, but they have interesting lives, and generally they're very successful when they enter the global community.
Well, that's good. That sort of sets the course for the future that you can would. I'm guessing that you would assume that in the future you're going to get better and better.
I believe we'll get better and better. Yeah. The faculty is outstanding. It was very good when I got there, but it's outstanding. The quality of the young faculty is just
that's outstanding. Really, that's great to see.
Yeah.
You were head of the history department. Did you call it chairman at that time?
Head was superior to chairperson.
All right. So for how many years did you do
just
that?
Just six. In our department, is the rotating three or six.
All right. I've always thought that it was a good thing to have somebody who was sort of reluctant to be department head or dean or whatever because the person was not in for a power play.
That's right.
And so it's always been one of the faculty members, and you rotate it.
Right. Power does corrupt, and in retrospect, there were things I should have seen and done better, although I was proud of my 6 years and happy to give it up.
I would like to turn now from, we've been talking a lot about the fact that you teach history, but you're also a Jewish chaplain.
Yeah.
So what kinds of activities do you get into as a chaplain on campus?
Everything. And that was true from the very, very beginning, from personal counseling, although pretty quickly early on I learned send the youngsters to the professionals if there's something really serious going on, and we have a wonderful counseling center. Multicultural events, interfaith events. Our Hillel Society at Lafayette College, and Hillel was a great rabbi, lived about 50 years before Jesus. They had a lot in common. Do unto others. Instead, it was don't do others what you would not have them do unto you. Love thy neighbor as thyself. Mm-hmm. All the rest is commentary. It's the liberal root of Jewish civilization. And so the Hillel Society is the national Jewish student organization, or the most important one. In the last 25 years, and even much more so in the last 15, we have become a multicultural center on campus. Over the years, I was able to raise a lot of funds. We have Friday night services every week that are student-led. Following that, we have a dinner, and anyone on campus is welcome to come, and it's free.
You have all that at the Hillel House?
At the Hillel House, so we can get anywhere between 15 people for a lovely, informative, inspiring religious experience, and then 30 to 80 for dinner. And on a Friday night, maybe 25% of the youngsters will not be Jewish, but if it's a bagel brunch, it's going to be 50%. I can't wait till the first bagel brunch, the first Sunday before classes. There will be 250 students waiting to get into the Hillel House.
Oh my goodness.
And this has been for 10 years now. It is the beginning. That's one of the official markers of the beginning of the school year, the first Hillel brunch. So the college and all of the major elements in the college have inspired this push to real diversity, ongoing diversity. It's no longer play acting, getting a couple of it's the culture. And those people who want to be part of that culture experience the culture totally. So if 35 years ago the Hillel officers might be active in other groups, but mainly Hillel would be their thing. Today, our Hillel officers are doing 3, 4, 5 other things on campus, whether it's the newspaper or the International Students Association or Social Action. It's constant, and it's deep. It's enlightening. It's life-giving, and it prepares them to be leaders wherever they make their home.
Well, I think it's great. It's a great thing when we have people of different faiths getting together. Anytime we can do that. So that's happening at Lafayette College nowadays. Do you coordinate with other chaplains on campus?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We have a head chaplain, Alex Hendrickson, who is wonderful and inspiring to students. And we always have a Catholic chaplain. We always have a Muslim chaplain, usually like myself, as a faculty member. And we do meet together, and we meet in other contexts also, in other committees that function on campus. So there may be a chaplain's meeting. There may be a chaplain's student meeting. There may be a multicultural meeting from another organization, and many of the same people may be showing up for that. So, yes, we're in contact quite a bit.
Is the religion department, as far as courses are concerned, is that called religion studies?
Yeah, religious studies.
Religious studies.
Yes.
At Lehigh University, it's religion studies, and now at Muhlenberg College, it's religion studies. So different
emphasize
titles.
The academic structure of it rather than the contact with religion as faith.
As if it were proselytizing,
for instance. That's right.
So have you taught courses in that department?
No, I teach, I've taught modern Jewish history in the history department. I've taught that at Lehigh also. I've taught American Jewish history in the history department. I have taught Middle East seminars in the history department and Holocaust studies in the history department. I've lectured for faculty in the religion department, but we're close colleagues. So what we do is adjust those courses based on student needs and our interests at any particular time. And I will say publicly that I used to teach the seminar in the Middle East at a pretty high level, even though it wasn't one of my special areas of study. I got a Mellon grant for 6 months just to study the Middle East, so I could do that in the department when we didn't have a Middle East historian. And by the mid-90s, I was so heartbroken by what I saw that it became difficult for me to spend five straight months teaching the Middle East because what I saw was more pain. And so for a light change of pace, I took up Holocaust studies and stopped teaching the Middle East.
Wow.
And that is also because by that time we had enough information about Jewish resistance and Christian rescuers that I could teach what I thought would be realistic history and we had a lot of cinematography by that time that could be used, things that had been hidden or lost, major new kinds of literature that meant that I felt I could teach it in a really academic but also personal manner. And I get special students for that, and usually, again, the majority of students are not Jewish in my Holocaust classes. And even in my modern Jewish history class today, half the students are not Jewish. When I first taught it, 95% of the students were Jewish.
Interesting.
Incredible.
Well, let's face it, you've built a reputation as an interesting professor, and even if that is embarrassing for me to say right now with you here, but that plays a big role. Yeah. Students say, you know, don't graduate without having a course from Dr. Wiener or from a really top professor. And that all plays into it.
Thank you.
We are just about to the end of our time together, unfortunately, Dr. Wiener. I want to ask you about the pronunciation of Wiener instead of Weiner?
Well, I want to know what my real name is. As with so many children of immigrants, the joke is the family name was Boehner. Boehner in Yiddish means bones. When the first relatives came across, the guys at Ellis Island said, "You don't want to be known as Mr. Bones. We'll just change it to Weiner." And they didn't understand the implications of that either when they did it. So we didn't come from Vienna. Half came from Ukraine and half came from central Poland. But Weiner is, it should be Weiner, Herr Weiner.
Right,
Herr
if Weiner. It's from German.
Yeah, that's right.
And then, all right, so you go back to Ellis Island. So whether it's at W-E-I or a W-I-E.
Right.
Who knows?
That's
The scribe who put it down?
That's it.
And that's what became your family name.
That's what became our family name.
So you were born in Philadelphia.
In Philly, 43.
How about your parents?
Mom came when she was 8 from Poland. She could have been in the ghetto of Grodno, Warsaw, or Bialystok. That's where she would go for medical attention from this little Jewish village in the center of Poland. My dad was born in the United States, although his mother was functionally illiterate in English. Right. He graduated from Wharton School and Penn Law School.
Oh, wow. Okay. And where was the mother from?
Ukraine.
Kiev.
Yeah.
Dr. Robert Weiner, I thank you so much for coming over and enlightening us on your career at Lafayette College and how things have changed through the years. It's been really an interesting hour. I do want to end on a light note, and that is you mentioned your love of Dijon and
yes.
your many experiences there. Burgundy wine.
Yes.
Which you came to appreciate a little bit late, but you're still in that appreciation mode. One of the wine cellars in Burgundy, I saw a saying that I really like. If you drink, you will die. If you don't drink, you will die. So drink.
In moderation, preferably red wine.
This is Dr. Robert Weiner, professor of history and the Jewish chaplain at Lafayette College. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to Lehigh Valley Discourse this evening. Thanks to Neil Heaver for his engineering work this evening. I'm your host, John Pierce. Until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.